versus Superintendent Fayette et al., appellate number 26-1291.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Ashley Orvitz on behalf of the appellant Superintendent Fayette et al. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That'll be granted.
Thank you. Your Honors, appellants respectfully request that the judgment of the district court granting the petition for writ of habeas corpus be reversed because appellee Mr. Williams has not demonstrated that the state court adjudication of his double jeopardy and related ineffectiveness claims were unreasonable applications of the facts or that his conviction was otherwise obtained in violation of the double jeopardy clause. First, the state courts determined that the mistrial at the end of Mr. Williams' second trial in 1998 was granted on defense request. Given the record before the state court, Mr. Williams cannot demonstrate that those rulings were unreasonable applications of facts. The state court credited two things. First, the statement at the end of the transcript where the trial court stated that the defendant's motion for mistrial would be granted, and two, the certified record of a docket entry indicating the same.
Well, if you look at those words are attributed to either the judge or some docket entry. What in the document can you say manifests a motion?
Sure, Your Honor. Well, first I would note that oral motions in Pennsylvania are relatively lax during trials, and there's several points in that 5 or 6 page transcript where I would say that a motion can be attributed to Mr. Elash's defense attorney. First, this very important defense witness indicated that he had changed his testimony significantly. Mr. Elash was going to be a witness. He stated, I cannot continue to represent this client during this trial. I am now a witness. I am now going to testify as an impeachment witness.
So that implicates the witness advocate rule under 3.7 of the Rules of Professional Conduct. But if you look at that rule, which is by implication what he was trying to invoke, that only requires disqualification unless it would work a substantial hardship. And if you look at the entire transcript, doesn't that indicate that Mr. Elash was trying to tell the court, my client's already had a trial? I don't know if my client has the means to continue it with third trial. Aren't those all indications that maybe the judge jumped the gun by making that declaration when you had, in addition, offers of alternatives by Mr. Elash?
No, Your Honor, I don't think this is a jumping the gun situation because the statement that I don't know if Mr. Williams has the funds to continue to a third trial, he's entitled to the appointment of counsel. So if he didn't have funds to get private counsel, that's immaterial. He could have gotten the public defender's office or other.
Wouldn't he have had counsel appointed to handle his examination, meaning Mr. Elash's examination and maybe the summation? I mean, there were other alternatives to the mistrial, and I guess I go back to what in the record demonstrates an application on the part of the defendant.
Sure. Well, I think the other alternatives to a mistrial doesn't necessarily go to whether or not there was a motion from the defense or if they even implicitly consented to it. Like, other alternatives were considered. I think your question about maybe appointing a lawyer in the middle of the trial to do those couple of things, that wasn't reasonable in this because they were in the middle of a several day long jury trial. This witness was the most important defense witness because this witness was going to provide the explanation as to why there was gunshot residue on the defendant's hand on the day that he was arrested. You couldn't feasibly expect a attorney to be appointed that morning whenever the Commonwealth is about to close its case, read the first trial transcript, catch up on the second trial transcript, talk to this witness, and then be prepared to question this witness and potentially Mr. Elash. And
that wasn't one of the alternatives that was discussed, but there were other alternatives. The sister testimony, waiving his testimony entirely, and so there'd be no ineffective assistance. I bring those up in context of where in the record is there a motion, because those acts all demonstrate a desire to proceed, not to mistry the case.
I think that they are alternatives that maybe we could have proceeded, but just because we could have proceeded doesn't mean there was a manifest necessity or not a manifest necessity to proceed. Like the judge,
I'm at motion. My first question was because you started with us saying there were factual findings. You didn't use these words that we have to defer to, because you get a presumption of correctness.
Correct.
Unless there's clear convincing evidence that finding was correct. Your reliance is on the statement of the court, motion for mistrial granted, and then a docket entry. My question for you is what preceding those lines would have indicated a desire on the part of the defendant to move for mistrial?
I think that very explicit statement by Mr. Elash, I cannot continue to represent this client, is an indication that he knows that this trial cannot continue. That's what I think that's what the state courts could reasonably have found the motion for. I think that's what the magistrate does in the report of recommendations credited as well in all these proceedings. The fact that Mr. Elash never expressly utters those words, I move for a mistrial, has been debunked time and time again by all the state courts. They're entitled to that deference under the habeas
litigation. Tell us, I don't know whether or not you're going to be able to answer this question. What happened after the judge said, I declare a mistrial? For example, do you know whether the jury was brought back in and discharged? Do you know if Mr. Williams was brought back into the court when there's a conversation? We scoured the district court docket and we didn't see anything to elucidate on what happened after that.
Sure. I don't know. That's certainly not in the record. There's not a continuation of the transcript. But that doesn't mean that that couldn't have happened. Courthouses are very busy. Just because this one trial is happening doesn't mean that when the mistrial was declared and the transcript ends, that they couldn't have been brought up. Mr. Elash could have said, Your Honor, hey, can we bring up Mr. Williams and put this on the record, discuss this a little bit more. He didn't do that. The lack of objection here is also highly compelling as to why this is a defense request for a mistrial.
Could we infer just that the fact that defense counsel raised it is part of what bears on whether it's a motion?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yeah, you could certainly infer that. And I think they're based off of the transcript and the state court findings. You could certainly do that. Yes, Your Honor.
This was in stay order. The prosecutor had a witness advocate problem, so, right?
Certainly.
Was that explored at all?
Well, I don't know. Also, the detective took the second statement from the witness whenever he went out and confirmed the statement from the prosecutor that he never was cleaning the gun. So if got to the point where there was going to be a potential impeachment by the police officer could have went there, I confirmed this, here's my report. So maybe not as significant as a witness advocate problem on the prosecutor's side because of the police officer being there.
Well, the prosecutor took the first statement and then the detective goes out. Maybe he doesn't have a witness advocate problem because he's not going to make any arguments to the jury. But then the prosecutor who deployed the agent during the trial has a witness tampering problem, no?
I don't believe that there's any evidence of witness tampering in this case, Your Honor. I think that was just normal prosecutorial follow-up. I don't think that there's any...
It raises some sensitive issues to go out, send law enforcement out in the middle of a trial to a sensitive witness who then changes their testimony, doesn't it?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that that's just...
After a stipulation was in place, I mean, this whole thing comes about because everybody previously stipulated this, right?
I get it. You have a client, and that's fair.
Yeah.
But these are the kinds of things that are also relevant to what a trial judge is looking at in terms of what are the appropriate next steps, right?
Sure. You can take all these circumstances into account. And if, you know, you're not inclined to say that there was an express express motion or he didn't move, there's also implied consent that we can talk about. You know, there's plenty opportunities in that transcript where Mr. Elash could have objected to that mistrial. The trial judge clearly stated his intentions to declare a mistrial. We are at a point where this trial cannot continue. That's a very clear statement.
But then then counsel offered some alternatives. They were rejected. The judge, Mr. Elash heard that. And at the PCRA hearing, Mr. Elash said, I wasn't going to argue with the judge's ruling after he gave it. So I don't know what we expect of an attorney to do after the judge already rejected his alternatives and made the declaration.
Well, Your Honor, I think we certainly expect defense attorneys to protect their client's interests, right? So whenever there's that one statement, we cannot continue that trial, and then they reject alternatives, and if he knows that Mr. Williams wants to continue this trial, he wants this jury to decide this case, he should have been prepared to place an objection on the record or state, Your Honor, I certainly object to a mistrial at this point. Give me 5 minutes to go talk to Mr. Williams. There was plenty of time for him to do that. This was not a sudden declaration of a mistrial. There was calm, deliberate discussion of this witness advocate problem. And Mr. Elash said, even in that PCRA hearing, I knew we were contemplating a mistrial. Mm-hmm. So if he knew that we were contemplating a mistrial and he didn't place an objection despite having 5 or 6 or 7 minutes of transcript to do so, we can imply consent here. There are plenty of opportunities to place a mistrial. He could also have said it right then and there whenever the judge said, okay, defendant's motion for a mistrial is granted. He could have said, no, judge, I never asked for one. He didn't do that.
I'd like to ask you if you can decipher something on the transcript. I don't know if you're going to be able to do this, but before the trial court, Mr. Elash said, quote, I'm going to be a witness. If Mr. Rodesis wants to supplement, that is my understanding, close quote. This is at 55. Can you tell me what that means, what that's a reference to?
Well, my interpretation of that is that he intends to be a witness if that witness is somehow impeached, right?
So with that, if that's the understanding, then should the judge waited to see whether or not the witness actually appeared, what he testified to, and whether or not it even implicated a need for any kind of impeachment? My point is, if that's the case, didn't the judge act prematurely?
No, I don't think he needed to wait, because I think both parties were very intent on impeaching this witness in one way, shape, or form. Mr. Elash was going to impeach him if he didn't talk about cleaning. Mm-hmm. The prosecutor most likely was going to impeach him with a new statement if he talked about cleaning. So I think whatever happened with that witness's testimony, he was going to be impeached by Mr. Elash as a witness. So waiting and trying to see what happens, I think the trial court just read the writing on the wall. There was nothing that they could have done to finish that trial.
But in trial number 3, when that very testimony was offered, there was no testimony about the cleaning of the gun from the witness. The trial judge precluded Mr. Elash from testifying.
Your Honor, there was some discussion about cleaning during this third trial, just a little bit. So I think that there was no need to impeach, because either the defense attorney didn't go far enough or the prosecutor chose not to impeach.
Either way, Mr. Elash never had to testify. And
sure,
if the trial judge had allowed the testimony to proceed, we may have ended up in the same place and the need for the witness advocate problem resolved itself.
Sure, but just because another judge may have chose to wait and see, defer until this witness is maybe testifies inconsistently, doesn't mean that the trial court abused its discretion in doing it the way that it did. Arizona versus Washington, the Supreme Court case on manifest necessity, the Supreme Court said, sure, this trial was not strictly necessary in that moment. Another judge might have gave a cautionary instruction to that opening statement. So since another judge might have waited and seen, doesn't mean that we acted properly in this instance.
You know, it's interesting because you raise Arizona, and I think it's one of the Supreme Court cases that begin to talk about consideration of alternatives, mm-hmm, and the need to kind of consider alternatives before we get to this kind of manifest necessity point. It talks about that as a standard, but doesn't really say whose burden it is. Is that on some party it's kind of tied up, as Judge Schwartz kind of said, at least me, it's in the motion issue. Is a judge supposed to sit there and say, okay, I've got something here, I'm now going to conduct my own manifest, I want to hear from you and you on manifest necessity? Or it seems like a little bit of an awkward thing for a trial judge to kind of go and on their own make a record. Is that a movement's issue? And if we don't have a movement, then who does it? Like, procedurally, how do we go and make sure that we've got this kind of complete record that at least 2 Supreme Court cases and 2 of our cases say is a good idea?
Sure. My time is up. Can I answer that question?
So
I think that it's way too strict of an interpretation of these cases to say that we need to pause, like collaborate and listen almost, and be like, okay, here's all the alternatives that I'm thinking of. Here's all the alternatives that I'm thinking of. Here's all the alternatives that I'm thinking of. So long as there is enough basis in the record for us to discern how the trial court made its decision, I think Arizona versus Washington is satisfied. So who's responsible for doing so? Maybe all of us, maybe the move-in, or maybe the defense attorneys. I don't know if I necessarily have an answer to that question for you, but the cases certainly do not say that we have to have this intellectual discussion and assess all possible alternatives. Crawford versus Fenton says we don't have to do that. It's just part of the consideration. And here, we consider some alternatives. Maybe there were some others that we could have, but just because there was others that others were done doesn't mean there wasn't an error. Thank you.
We'll have you back on rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. Connor Baer from Jones Day on behalf of the appellee, Jennifer Williams. When the state court declared a mistrial in the middle of Mr. Williams' second trial, it did so only because it mistakenly believed in the spur of the moment that Mr. Williams' lawyer had become a necessary witness. That determination was unasked for and unnecessary, and it is undisputed here that the premise for that determination was legally incorrect. The trial judge only got to that premise by rejecting other available options that would have obviated the lawyer's testimony. And as the government expressly conceded—
What's the legally incorrect part?
Your Honor, the court's decision was legally incorrect by rejecting the possibility for Mr. Williams to waive his Sixth Amendment right to an
effective— Aren't some Sixth Amendment issues arising from potential conflicts unwaivable?
I don't know that that's correct, Your Honor. It is a discretionary determination for the district court, for the trial court.
I think
court.
My question suggests that it's correct.
Well, Your Honor, here, in for example, in the Arrington case, in the Molino case, in the McCoy case, in each of those situations, there's an additional conflict in Molino and Arrington, for example, where the defense attorney actually did witness tampering with the prosecution witness. And in that situation, he bore—
This is kind of the flip side of that. Your adversary can't say she has ethical obligations, but don't you think it's the flip side of that?
I think Mr. Elash certainly perceived it that way, Your Honor. He said so with the PCRA testimony that—
We look at this record with an experienced trial judge, and we can't infer that the judge understood that too. I mean, there are references to the conflict being unwaivable, potentially unwaivable.
I don't know that that's an unwaivable conflict for Mr. Williams, though, Your Honor.
Is that and your again, call or the trial judge's call in the state court?
But the trial judge did not make a discretionary determination. He rejected it out of hand. He said he could not, which is exactly what this court
sounds
said in
like
footnote 3.
When he says could not, it sounds like he's saying unwaivable.
I believe
there's even an argument that that's what he's saying. How do you win?
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor, because here's, first of all, we're talking about manifest necessity here, which was not decided by the state court. So this is de novo review. Secondly, whenever Mr. Elash proposed to the court—
It's relevant to whether there was a motion also. The defense counsel is up there. It's up there for a reason. He's not just, you know, having idle chit-chat with his adversary and the judge. Is up there to make an application. Application is in part based, it has to, calls into question whether the conflict is waivable. And, it, you know, to my understanding, a trial judge can make a decision about whether a Sixth Amendment conflict is waivable separate from the rules of professional responsibilities. Do you have a case that says that's wrong?
I think McCoy, Arrington, and Molina all stand for the fact that the courts have to recognize that there are waivable conflicts, and then they have to go to make the second step of the determination of whether it is in fact waivable.
Did any of those cases say that the experienced state court trial judge in a habeas proceeding has to make those calls and those decisions out loud and explicit? Or do we defer to a trial judge managing active live proceedings?
I think McCoy stands for the proposition, Your Honor, that the trial judge cannot act hastily and reject a possible waiver out of hand. Or the proper approach in that instance is to pause the proceedings and allow the parties to consider whether they actually want to waive the Sixth Amendment problem.
No,
what happened?
Can I just go to this? It seems like the starting point, once we put across the issue of like waiver of procedural default in the briefing, which no one's really making a big deal out of, but it seems like the real starting point is there a motion? And it seems that state court proceedings, it's just a bad time for like rigid formalism. Formalism has its day, but these proceedings aren't it. So let me just ask you a hypothetical. It doesn't have to be a criminal case, but it's a civil case, and a plaintiff's lawyer comes in and says, Your Honor, I just want to let you know, I can't make the trial scheduled for August 15th. I'm open all September, but I got a hearing in front of the Court of Appeals on August 15th. And so it's obviously I can't attend. And the trial judge says, yeah, I'll grant your motion for a continuance. Do you think that plaintiff's lawyer's statement was a motion for a continuance?
In that situation, Your Honor, I don't know, because I would have to look at the record as a whole.
They come to freeze the record. This is the whole record. Walks up and says, I just want to let you know, I can't make trial starting August 15th. And it's because I got this conflict. My conflict is with the Court of Appeals argument, but I'm free all September. Is that a motion for, or is that not a motion for continuance? Is that something else? What is that?
In that situation, Your Honor, for a purely procedural question like that, potentially, I feel like we would have to understand more of what the
You think it's ambiguous?
Potentially, Your Honor, but here's...
If it was ambiguous and we were looking for clear and convincing evidence the other side, do you think that there would be clear and convincing... If a state court in habeas review said, you know what, that looks like a motion to me, do you think that from the record I've given you, the snapshot, that you'd have any clear and convincing evidence to the other side, to the contrary?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I think in the context of the Double Jeopardy Clause, when we're asking whether an individual has consented to going through the ordeal of a trial, there's a higher standard than whether somebody has asked for a trial continuance, first of all. Second of all, it is on the trial court at that time to make a clear record of what the request is. And the Pennsylvania Rules of Criminal Procedure dictate that motions have to request an order or some form of relief. In this instance—
Well, let's look at this record. This record has Mr. Elosh saying, I'm going to be a witness in one place. I cannot represent Mr. Williams in another place. The judge is confronted with a scenario where the lawyer who's representing a defendant in the middle of a criminal thing, I can't proceed. What else should the judge have inferred from that representation, particularly after his alternatives were rejected, such as the sister's testimony?
I'm glad you brought that up, Judge Schwartz. And I think the clearest statement of intent about a mistrial here is Mr. Williams's declaration to the court that my client wants this trial to finish. And then thereafter, he proposed several alternatives to make that happen. As you noted, that's clear intent that he wants the trial to proceed. The trial court then improperly rejected those alternatives. McCoy and other cases show that it was possible. I think that he could have waived the ineffective assistance claim, but at minimum, it should have been on the trial judge to at least have a colloquy about that and undergo whether that's possible. And then thereafter
The Third Circuit recognizes the invited error doctrine, right? If you give bogus jury instructions to a trial judge, the trial judge uses those and reads them to a jury, you can't turn around and say, oh, look at that, huge error. You read the jury the wrong instructions. If you show up to a trial judge and say, hey, obviously I can't proceed. There's no way in the world I can keep this going. If you're wrong, and you could have proceeded, but the trial judge trusted you and relied on you, in this instance, you're saying, no, that reliance wasn't good enough. But in the jury instruction context, which is equally as important, that's grounds for instant reversal, somehow we recognize invited error and say, oh, hey, look, you baited the judge. You put the judge in that position. Didn't Mr. Elosh put the judge in a position by saying, quote, obviously I can't continue to represent him, and then later I'm going to be a witness? If he's wrong, you're now putting it on the trial judge, much like you could put it on the trial judge to go and take the time and make the right jury instructions. But we recognize invited error that says, oh, if you come and you bait it, you can't later unring it.
I don't think so, Your Honor, and here's why. Because even after Mr. Elosh proposed alternatives, the trial court rejected them. The trial court recognized, and it's in the record, that the trial court thought this was a contingent situation. It was if Mr. Radoyce is going to put up this testimony. And then they go through another colloquy, and then Mr. Elosh says, yes, I'm going to be a witness if Mr. Radoyce wants to supplement, which the government just acknowledged is an indication that this was a hypothetical situation.
Is that clear from the record? The court says, we're left in a situation where there is no out in terms of the continuation of this particular trial. There's no contingency in that statement. It doesn't say, if Mr. Radoyce wants to be a witness, if you want to resolve this through something other than a stipulation, if there's no ifs to that. Straight up, we're left in a situation where there's no out in terms of the continuation of this particular trial. Where's the contingency there?
Well, at this point, Your Honor, it feels like we've moved now from an affirmative motion to implied consent. That the question is, if the court was now making this statement, was there a meaningful opportunity for Mr. Elosh to object after this point? And I would submit the answer is no, because even after that point in time, even the prosecutor was still discussing this as a contingent situation. He said that's a decision the defense is going to have to make, because here's the reality of the procedure. The reality was Mr. Fagnart was a defense witness, and whether or not a conflict eventually arose between Mr. Fagnart and Mr. Elosh was a decision the defense was going to have to make as to the scope of his testimony. This is exactly what played out in the third trial.
The potential conflict at the time of the colloquy that we're looking at, isn't it?
It's the same potential conflict that every lawyer has walking into a courtroom who has interviewed their witness previously and has her firsthand knowledge of what that interview had. But it doesn't become an actual conflict until the witness gets on the stand.
I agree there's different types of potential conflicts. This is a pretty severe one, no?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because, again, the third trial shows it was possible for Mr. Fagnard to testify without that testimony.
Some potential conflicts are waivable, I agree. But is there anything that says that a trial judge has to let a potential conflict like this hang over the rest of a trial?
I think that's exactly what the Manifest Necessity Clause requires, Your Honor.
Governs the Sixth Amendment?
Not the Manifest Necessity Clause, Double Jeopardy Clause.
The Jeopardy Clause governs the Sixth Amendment on this issue?
Sorry, I was trying to correct a misspeak. The Double Jeopardy Clause requires that there be manifest necessity for any mistrial, which this court and the Supreme Court have held time and again, requires the trial court to take a pause. That's Love, that's Russo, that's Rivera, that's Jorn, that's Ferris. I mean, each of these cases, this court says, whenever there was a possibility to pause for a moment and allow the situation to sort itself out. If the conflict was potential, certainly it could have sorted itself out. They didn't have to bring Mr. Fagnard to the stand. They didn't have to elicit the unhelpful testimony from him. And even if they had elicited that testimony.
If the conflict is potential, there's an argument after the fact, isn't there, that every decision the defense lawyer makes for the rest of the trial is impacted by that potential conflict?
I don't think so, Your Honor. At this point in time, that conflict was hypothetical at most, but that's not manifest necessity to declare a mistrial.
And are you relying on part based on the sequence in which the conversations occurred? For example, Judge Phipps asked you about the statement by the trial judge saying there's no out in terms of the continuation of this particular trial, which everybody understands to mean this can't go forward. Then Mr. Elash responds by saying, I don't know if he has the funds to go forward. I would have to let the court know. And then he says, I'm going to be a witness. And then a separate sentence, if Mr. Rodesis wants to supplement, that is my understanding. So is that, when you talk about a contingency in response to Judge Bowie's question, is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly, that if is doing a lot of work in that sentence. And it's the same contingency recognized by the prosecution later in the transcript where he says, this is a decision the defense is going to have to make. It was not on the table at that point in time. And this was not something that was caused by the plaintiff. Farris, the en banc decision from this court, stands for the proposition that just because somebody brings an issue to the judge's attention does not thereby mean that they asked for a mistrial or they didn't, it's not causing a mistrial.
But following back on Mr. Bowie's question, why should we say that the judge acted inappropriately by not allowing that eventuality to happen with the risk that he might have had a conflicted lawyer and couldn't proceed?
But the only possibility of having a conflicted lawyer, Your Honor, is if they decided to put Mr. Fagnard on the stand and if they then decided to have Mr. Fagnard elicit this unhelpful testimony. That was a decision for them to make. And if it didn't happen, there would be no conflict and there would be no mistrial. If the trial court had simply held correctly to pause for a second whenever Mr. Elash told the court, my client wants the trial to finish, he waived his Sixth Amendment rights, we could have the sister testify, he was proposing alternatives. If the trial court had not made errors of law in that situation, there would not have been a mistrial because they would not have gone down this hypothetical scenario.
We get to this point, though, where at least on the kind of the consent prong, it strikes me that if I were in Mr. Elash's shoes and the court said to me, we're left in a situation where there's no out in terms of continuation of this particular trial, that seems like a great invitation for me to begin to talk about all those alternatives. Oh my goodness, no, you're wrong. There's tons of outs. You think there's no out? Why don't we just pause? Why don't I just talk to my client? Why don't we just see what his feelings are? We've got a million outs here. Why don't I talk to the prosecutor again, see what we can do? I just want to bring this to your attention. But instead he says, I don't know what my client wants to do. And then he ends it with, obviously I can't continue to represent him. Isn't this the golden opportunity? If a judge says, I just don't see a way you can continue this, as an advocate, shouldn't you say, well, Your Honor, that's kind of wrong? There's a lot of things on the table. There's a lot of reasonable alternatives. Instead of saying, obviously I can't continue it, that's affirming of what the trial judge said, no?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because again, no? This was still hypothetical in that instance. He was saying, if Your Honor, if we're going to go down this path, this hypothetical path, that we can't waive the Sixth Amendment rights and the sister can't testify, both of which were incorrect, then, yeah, of course I can't continue to represent him. He's following the judge down this hypothetical path, and that's how they get to the mistrial. But that error of law in the first instance constitutes an abuse of discretion under any standard, which cannot support a manifest necessity here.
I have one question. I'll see if my colleagues have others. Do you have any idea what happened immediately after the declaration of the mistrial? We couldn't find anything in the record of the proceedings of the state court. Do you have any idea? Was the jury brought back in? Was the defendant Mr. Williams brought back in?
There's nothing in the record, to my knowledge, Your Honor, as to what exactly happened afterward. The best indication of it, I believe, is in the PCRA transcript, where Mr. Elash testified that what happened right after was that the trial ended. It was an abrupt ending, is basically how he put it. And the Pennsylvania law is quite clear that whatever's not in the record doesn't exist. It didn't happen, right? The record is the record. And so for all intents and purposes here,
that's it. Understood. Judge Roby?
No.
Okay, thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And we'll have you back on rebuttal.
Just a couple quick points. First, to Judge Bove, your question about waivable versus ineffective under the Sixth Amendment, I tend to agree with you that there are certain conflicts that are waivable, personal to the defendant, that being many Sixth Amendment claims. There is others that are non-waivable by the attorney themselves, this being one of them. So even if you want to agree that Mr. Williams could have potentially, we don't even know if he would have. There's no statement in the record that Mr. Williams would have waived. So we're just hypothetically thinking that he would have waived. So even if you wanted to do that, it still doesn't eliminate the witness advocate problem personal to Mr. Elash if we got to that point. And then one final point, I think if I'm understanding opposing counsel a little correctly, he almost wants the trial court to, in an attempt to avoid manifest necessity or a mistrial, to encourage the defense to tailor their own defense just so we avoid the point of a mistrial. I think that is almost illogical because it would take away the defendant's right to present the defense that they wanted to present. This testimony was so important to the defense that they did it in every single trial. There's no evidence that he would have waived it, tailored it, or done otherwise. Mr. Fanagert's cleaning testimony was central to the defense. And so I don't think it's reasonable to say that they would have tailored that in one way, shape, or form. And we have zero evidence in the record to that. So, Your Honor, unless there's no further questions, I would rest on my brief, and I would ask that you would reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. We thank counsel for the very helpful arguments and briefing. The court will take the matter under advisement, and we're going to take a brief recess before the next case.